What is up, you stewed prunes? Welcome to No Holds Barred, the Shakespeare podcast Shakespeare would have listened to. I'm Dan Bollier.
And I'm Kevin Condardo. We are back with this month's installment of So You're Going to See Shakespeare. The idea of this episode is that it's something you'll listen to in transit to a Shakespearean production so that we can prepare you to be the best little audience member that you can be.
An audio version of the dramaturgical notes, if you will.
So, hopefully, you'll enjoy this episode as you head out to see Measure for Measure.
Here we go.
The first thing we need to cover before we get into this episode is a quick synopsis of the play, so you at least know the story. Daniel, kick us off.
Yes. So, the action kicks off when the Duke decides to take a vacation and leave Angelo, his second-in-command, in charge while he's out of town. He says his goodbyes and goes to a monastery, where he explains to a local friar that he's going to go into hiding because he knew he'd become too lenient as a ruler and wants to have a stickler for the rules in charge for a bit. And also to see what absolute power will do to the personality of his most trusted second.
In another part of town, the patrons of a local bar hear a rumor that Claudio has been sentenced to death for impregnating his fiancée, Juliet. They happen to find Claudio in the street, who emphasizes that he and Juliet had already been engaged, they just hadn't gotten married yet because they don't have the money in place. With the more sympathetic Duke out of town, Claudio decides to have his sister Isabella, who is currently training to become a nun, go to Angelo to plead on his behalf. Isabella doesn't think this is going to work, but she agrees to go give it a shot anyways.
Both Aeschylus, Angelo's second-in-command, and the provost, who will have to carry out the execution, check in with Angelo to make sure he wants to go through with this, and he's still totally in. He does agree to hear Isabella's plea, however, and after hearing it, reveals he's kind of fallen in love with her and wants to have her come in to plea again as soon as possible.
After having the night to think it over, Angelo offers Isabella a proposal. He'll spare her brother's life if she sleeps with him.
Seems fair.
She is not down with this idea. She says she's going to go tell everyone that this is what he's offering, and he asks her who she thinks the public will believe, him or her. She ultimately decides against taking up Angelo on his offer, despite what it means for her brother.
Meanwhile, the Duke has been snooping around town while disguised as a friar, first to visit Juliet and then to visit Claudio. While visiting, Isabella arrives, and the Duke scurries away to eavesdrop in private, like you do when you're a disguised friar. Mm-hmm. Isabella tells Claudio of Angelo's disgusting offer, which Claudio doesn't think is so bad when you really think about it. Isabella is disgusted.
But before she can storm out, the Duke, in disguise, appears to reveal an interesting little bit of Angelo's personal history. In his youth, he abandoned his fiancée at the altar because she lost her dowry, but she is still out there, and she is still deeply in love with him. Naturally, the Duke, in disguise, suggests that Isabella tell Angelo she's agreed to take his offer, and Angelo should come to visit her at her place in the middle of the night, but then before she arrives, Mariana, who is Angelo's estranged fiancée, should take her place in her bed so that Angelo will sleep with his once betrothed instead of the training nun. Somehow, everyone thinks this is a great idea, so they go forward with it.
The Duke and Isabella go to Mariana to lay out the plan, and for some godforsaken reason, she thinks it's a good idea too, and she agrees to participate. The Duke reassures Mariana and Isabella and the audience and the readers that since Mariana and Angelo were once engaged, this is totally normal and we don't need to feel bad about it.
Definitely apologizing in advance for this entire conceit. After sleeping with Mariana, who he thought was Isabella, in exchange for sparing Claudio, Angelo goes into work the next morning to send a note to the executioner to definitely execute Claudio immediately anyways, mostly because Angelo is the worst. Fortunately, the Duke in disguise is still loitering around and is able to talk the executioner out of it before he kills Claudio. Double fortunately, one of the prisoners who died of natural causes that morning happened to look just like Claudio. So they decide to cut the head off of his corpse and send it to Angelo to prove that they did indeed kill Claudio. Everyone, again, agrees this is definitely the best idea for this situation.
A few days later, the Duke makes his grand re-entrance into the city. He sends one of his friar friends off to find Isabella and Mariana, who are pretty displeased about the Duke still killing Claudio anyway after the evening they arranged, to make sure they find him shortly for the grand reveal, in case the two of them didn't get the memo that that's what happens at the end of, like, all of Shakespeare's plays.
The Duke meets with Angelo in the public square, and Isabella immediately jumps out of the crowd to accuse Angelo of what he's definitely actually done. The Duke pretends to not believe her. She says that she has a friar who will back up her story and drops the name of the guy the Duke was being when he was in disguise. Mm-hmm. Angelo immediately chimes in and says he's heard of that guy and he sucks and he hates the Duke. At that moment, Mariana comes in, veiled, and says that the story is a lie because Angelo did sleep with someone that night, her, in Isabella's bed. Mm. The Duke takes this exact moment to, like, take a phone call or something, and he slips out into the crowd. A few minutes later, a friar who looks suspiciously like the Duke appears and says Isabella is right. The court says he's full of it, but when they go to take him away, his hood falls off and they realize it's really the Duke, and they all collectively gulp like they're in a Looney Tunes cartoon. The Duke forgives Aeschylus, his third in command, condemns Angelo to marry Mariana when Angelo was actually begging for execution, which is a pretty tough draw, pardons Claudio and Juliet, and asks Isabella to marry him because who said romance is dead? Oh, and that is Measure for Measure.
A comedy.
Now that you know what you'll be watching, we're going to take a few minutes to talk about where Measure for Measure falls in Shakespeare's personal timeline and what was happening in the world when it was written. Daniel.
Yes. So Measure for Measure was written somewhere between 1603 and 1604. That's what I have here. In terms of what things that Shakespeare was working on at this time, we have All's Well That Ends Well, Timon of Athens, and Othello are all in the same pocket. So I think he's having a rough time.
Yeah, he's in a bit of a slump.
A little bit of a slump. What might be informing that, I think, is we know that in 1603, James becomes the king.
Mm-hmm.
In this period, so it's you can sort of imagine Shakespeare feeling out. For me, it's like, is he feeling out who the new guy is? What does he like?
Sure.
He's just kind of like stalling with these plays. Mm-hmm. I mean, some people like them and they would tell me I'm an idiot, but I think this is like the worst chunk of Shakespeare's career.
He's not rolling out the Hamlets and the King Lears that are waiting.
Exactly. And they're coming soon. So it feels to me a lot like, you know, it's the new king. But this is also, it's interesting that you have someone in a period where James is taking over power, a new ruler for the first time in a long time, mm-hmm. to do a play about someone else absorbing power.
Yes. And it's funny because there are a lot of things in this play that the Duke does that can be drawn pretty straight line to some of the experiences that James had in the first year or two of his rule. The first one is in March 1604, the king and the queen made what they wanted to be a private visit to the exchange. They literally got disguised and went down to the exchange to kind of feel it out. But word got out and they were absolutely mobbed by everyone being there to try and see the king at the exchange, which he was quite displeased about.
I bet.
Clearly needed to work on his disguise game. Another parallel example is James's had a kind of obsession with justice with mercy hand in hand.
Right.
And one example of that was in April 1603. He went in person to sentence a pickpocket to death, but pardoned all the prisoners in the tower, showing that justice should be combined with mercy. Don't really know if that was the right call,
right?
With like a sentence of context.
I mean, pickpocketing is an egregious fault.
Right. And we don't know what those prisoners were in there for.
Right.
But who are we to say? Who are we to judge?
It's like pardoning the turkeys, right?
Yeah, kind of. The important thing is that he wasn't a blood and guts cut off with their heads type.
Right. The pickpocket also was just fined $1 million and 4 games. This we know that this Measure for Measure was based on a tale by Cinthio, Giraldo Cinthio. It's a moral tale which was widely popular in 16th century Europe, and it appeared in a number of different forms. Cinthio is important because this is the first. He's one of the first writers of tragicomedy, mm-hmm. which is again just like combining justice with mercy. It's a play that combines really tragic elements with comedic elements. This mm-hmm. technically is a comedy,
right.
But there's a lot of tragedy in it,
sure,
and a lot of really serious stakes.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something that Cinthio was one of the first people to be doing, and Shakespeare kind of picks up on that
sure.
in Measure for Measure.
So there you go. That's a little bit of what was going on in Shakespeare's time when Measure for Measure was written. This is where we identify what we consider to be the most prominent theme in the play and particular places where you may see it come up. Dan has chosen his three favorites, and I'm going to take my choice of those for us to dig in on.
Yes.
Daniel.
Yes.
Who are our finalists?
The finalists for Miss Best Theme in Measure for Measure are religion, leadership, and power. Religion, leadership, and power.
Let's talk about power.
Yes, let's.
So I think, you know, the interesting thing here is there are different types of power that we see displayed throughout this play. The Duke appoints Angelo because he has ultimate power. Mm-hmm. He hands that power over because he knows he's not using his power correctly.
Right.
That, you know, that he's been too lenient and he knows he, I think there's a scene in there where he says, you know, I could just be like, okay, guys, no, seriously, we're going to start taking this seriously now. And the people would be like, totally, yeah, all right. So he needed a visual, you know, to send that image. I don't know whether, like, there needed to be a milestone, a benchmark that, like, stuff changed.
Right.
So he gives that power over. There's Angelo and the abuse of that power or the application. Well, the abuse of the power is what he does with Isabella.
Right.
That he could, you know, he was in there, brought in to use the law, you know, to use that power correctly in the way that the Duke was not.
Right.
And then he uses it to get laid. And then there's...
Tried to get laid. Well, you know, he doesn't get laid. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's Isabella's power as a sexual being.
Yep.
That it, that Angelo is willing to trade not only his actual power, but also cost himself power in bastardizing, you know, and cheapening his position and using it for ill gains to, you know, because of the power she holds over him as a sexual being.
Right, 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 right. Absolutely. And also there's the, look at Claudio's power as her brother. Mm-hmm. When talking about Isabella, his, you know, he is in jail for something that really, I mean, he is, you got someone pregnant, but he was betrothed to marry her.
Right.
And both of them are like, he's like, I love her. And she's like, he loves me and I love him.
Yeah. And he's, and like, we'll get married right now if you want.
Right. And they're like, nope, you're in jail. So that's in a, you know, a stripping of power.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Isabella goes to him and he pleads to her,
mm-hmm.
there is that fraternal power of, you know, I mean, you can family. Do this for me.
Yeah.
You have the power to literally do this.
Right.
Should you choose to do it. And she's like, well, do you want to live a couple more years so that I can be damned forever? Because this is what you're asking me to do is eternal, like the power, you know, the awe and power of the afterlife.
Right.
And that fear.
And he's like, well, maybe.
Maybe kind of. I wouldn't mind living. I really kind of want to meet my baby.
I mean, and then at kind of the other end of the spectrum, there's some power struggles between, you know, Mistress Overdone.
Yes.
And her dealings with Pompey.
Yep.
Probably one of my favorite, maybe my favorite power struggle in the entire canon is when they tell Barnardine it's time to get executed. And he's like, I'm not dying today. I'm not doing it. And they're like, you are. This is a jail and we're going to cut your head off. And he's like, no, I have a hangover. Leave me alone. And they do.
Right.
For
There's
a while.
Power in that.
Right. So, you know.
The other thing with Mistress Overdone, that plot is, when they're basically like, okay, brothels and bod, we're cleaning all that up. And they're like, what? No, this is like how we, like, that's how we make our living.
Right.
And it's like, nope, new sheriff in town, literally new sheriff in town.
Right.
And you're all going to jail, which is taking someone's, the power they have to live away from them.
Sure.
Which is
using that power that way. Yeah.
So there you go. Power is everywhere.
Power. Keep your eye out for it as you go out to see Measure for Measure. In this section of the show, we choose which non-title characters we would most want to play in this piece and explain why in 2 minutes or less. Dan won the coin flip before the show.
Yes!
And has elected to go first.
Yes,
so,
I
Daniel.
Have. Yes, of course, yes.
Kick us off.
Wonderful. So, in Measure for Measure, this is actually one of those plays that, despite the fact that people listening to the podcast know I really don't like this play, there are a tremendous number of roles in here I'd like to play, just never publicly, just like for myself, because the play is terrible.
Sure.
But that being said, I think it'd be really fun to tackle Pompey.
Yes, totally.
Fun clown. I read a description of Pompey from the fine folks over at playshakespeare.com today, which I think really tells you why I should play this role. And I quote, Pompey Bum is Mistress Overdone's bartender and helps her in pimping. He speaks a great deal and can almost talk his way out of risky situations simply by gabbling on so much that he wears out the listener.
Yep.
Though sent off with only a warning from Aeschylus the first time he's arrested for being a pimp, he returns immediately to his trade. He believes Lucio to be a genuine friend of his. He accepts to become an executioner's assistant to gain his freedom, and is amused to recognize that almost everyone imprisoned as former clients of Mistress Overdone's. He is a fellow with a large rear end.
Interesting.
And I have a lot of junk in my trunk. Dash. Great butt. Tremendous, tremendous butt.
What is happening?
And I think I'd be great as Pompey, the clown. I'm fun, lovable, and I'm going to tell you more about it if you want. I'll keep talking if you'd like me to tell you more about why I should play Pompey Bum, the greatest clown in this play.
Are you vamping?
The only clown in the play.
So you don't want this remaining 40 seconds?
No, I'm good. Okay. I'm just trying to wear out the listener.
Oh,
I'm just
I see.
Talking and gabbling on about how great I am. He also has, like, just the scenes are so fun.
And Thomas Tapster is, like, the best nickname. Like, be a great boxing nickname. Thomas Tapster!
Finishing move is the last call.
Yes.
Perfect.
Uh-huh.
It'd be great.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, no, boxing. They don't have finishing moves. It's just finishing moves knock your goddamn head off.
Traditionally, yes.
Right. So, yeah, I would play Pompey Bum.
All right, there you go. For me, who I would really want to play... I'll just take 2 seconds on. I would like to play Barnadine, the prisoner.
Great.
Like in a cameo, especially right. Since like this would be if I was working at a theater, like a regional theater someplace and at the smaller end and I was actually doing my day job.
Right.
Like in the office.
Right.
And they needed someone for like one scene. Like
call me up.
Over the summer.
And it's a
neighborhood cameo. Right. Exactly.
Perfect.
Like that would be a lot of fun just because I think that scene is so much fun, especially in a place where you know the actors, like if there's some rapport.
It's a great role for you.
I'm not doing it. You know. But I think I really
like two answers. This is great.
Yes. Well, I can't get 2 minutes out of that. I like Elbow in this play. Elbow the Constable.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's the same shtick as Dogberry, but there's something about Elbow that's a little more earnest, I find.
Yeah.
I don't know, and maybe it's just in the interpretations I've seen
of
that. I feel like when people play Dogberry, they're playing their Dogberry. It's
right.
Like people play their Hamlet and their, you know, it's like you get a whole lot of Dogberry, but I feel like Elbow doesn't have that same esteem.
Right.
And this is more in, I'm interpreting the productions of it I've seen.
Sure.
Where Elbow doesn't, you're not like, oh yeah, Elbow.
Right.
He just comes on, he has good bits. You have that, you know, I do lean upon justice, and he puts his elbow out and leans on it. And there are great scenes that he and Pompey have, so there we go.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it's the clown, and it's, you know, I think it's a good, there are good scenes in there for the clowning in this one, in a play that needs it, you know. The main storyline of this one is such kind of a...
It's heavy matter.
It's a tough one.
Yeah.
So when you see Mistress Overdone and Elbow and the undercard come through, you need them to really bring it. So
a nice
I would
little
like
pop.
Elbow. This is the section of the show where we pull our favorite phrase from this play and talk through it so that you can nod smugly and knowingly when you hear it. The line we chose from Measure for Measure is, "To have what we would have, we speak not what we mean." From Act 2, Scene 4. Let's hear the phrase in context. What would you do?
As much for my poor brother as myself. That is, were I under the terms of death, the impression of keen whips I'd wear as rubies, and strip myself to death as to a bed that longing have been sick for, ere I'd yield my body up to shame.
Then must your brother die.
And 'twere the cheaper way. Better it were a brother died at once. Than that a sister, by redeeming him, should die forever.
Were not you, then, as cruel as the sentence that you have slandered so?
Ignominy and ransom and free pardon are of two houses. Lawful mercy is nothing kin to foul redemption.
You seemed of late to make the law a tyrant, and rather proved the sliding of your brother a merriment than a vice.
Ah, pardon me, my lord. It oft falls out, to have what we would have... We speak not what we mean. I something to excuse the thing I hate for his advantage that I dearly love.
We are all frail.
Else let my brother die. If not a Federy, but only he, and succeed thy weakness.
Nay, women are frail too.
Aye, as the glasses where they view themselves, which are as easy broke as they make forms. Women, help heaven, men, their creation mar in profiting by them.
That is to have Aces. What we would have. We speak not what we mean from Woo. Act 2, Scene 4 of Measure for Measure. Dan.
Woo. Yeah.
Can you give us some context on this?
Sure. This is the aforementioned scene when Isabella has come in to talk to Angelo and be like, hey, please don't kill my brother. Mm-hmm. And he's like, sure, definitely won't kill your brother if you sleep with me. Mm-hmm. And she's like, nah, I don't think so. It's better that he dies at once than my soul go to hell for right. all time. And he's like, so you're basically killing him because you just said, you know, you'd do anything. And then she's like, not that.
Right. That's not what I meant.
That's not what I meant. So this is a little tongue in cheek. Like sometimes, you know, we say things when we want something.
Right.
But we don't think through every letter of the word, what we're saying.
Right.
When she's like, I would do anything. I don't mean I would do you. I mean, I would do anything reasonable.
Right. Just and logical and relevant.
Yeah.
You know.
And I would do things I hate for someone I love.
Right.
But not at the expense of my soul.
Right. So to have what we would have, we speak not what we mean. It's kind of the turning point of this scene, right?
Yeah.
Or at least it could be a big point here.
Yeah.
That, you know, Angelo is all about the letter of the law.
Right.
That's why he was brought in there.
Right.
To look at every word and follow each one to the letter.
Right.
So for Isabella to come in and say, basically, I meant the spirit of this thing, not literally what I said.
Right.
That kind of sums up the play, right?
Exactly.
You know, where it's like, that's what really the Duke was doing.
Right. She represents where they have been as a culture and
right.
in this town. Like, oh, no, I didn't mean that. It's like, well, we mean what we say now.
Right. And I mean, probably what Shakespeare thinks is the way that it should be.
Yeah.
Right? That it's like, it's not about following everything to a T.
Right.
It's about the spirit of the law, the spirit of what's right.
Right, right,
and,
right.
You know, for the spirit of what's right is more important than literally what was written down as a guidepost.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
It's also, this is neat, I think, that in this scene, and we were just sort of looking at it as we were prepping, the scansion's all over the place. They have shared lines, half lines, mm-hmm. fragmentations, completely irregular lines. And then we get this, to have what we would have, we speak not what we mean.
Uh-huh.
It's a 12-syllable line, but still monosyllabic, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3. Yeah. So frequently on a 12-syllable line, it is a turning point.
Mm-hmm.
You have the first six and the last six are, it's a change of heart or change
right.
of idea. So in a good production, I think this is the moment where Isabella can make a choice.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, she's, what if he catches her off guard?
Right.
With this moment of, you're killing your brother.
Right.
Basically what he says to her, you're killing your
yeah,
brother.
This is your fault.
And she has to choose in that moment. That really clarifies, oh, pardon me, my lord. Ah,
mm.
It's like, that oh, could be the moment of realizing, oh, no, I can't do it.
Right.
Which is, I think, more interesting than someone who just comes in and is like, nope, not doing it.
Right.
And he's like, you're going to do it. And she's like, nope. Like, that's not a really...
No.
Good scene.
Right. You have to have at least a moment of consideration.
Yeah.
Right.
I think this is where it is.
It's called dramatic tension.
Dramatic tension for those of you scoring at home.
You know.
Yeah. So yeah, a 12 syllable monosyllabic line is pretty rare.
Yeah.
So it's worth talking about.
Yeah. And so for it to be, hopefully your Isabella starts from a point where she can use it as a turning line.
Right.
Otherwise, this will be a long, unbending road that
right.
we go on.
If she storms through it, just throw vegetables and leave.
That's your answer for everything.
Yeah, of course.
So there you go.
Tomato.
That's the line, tomato. To have what we would have, we speak not what we mean, from Act 2, Scene 4. Let us know how it's played in the production that you're going to see.
Yeah.
Here, we will highlight the biggest practical challenge to the director in this play and share a few ideas on how it has been solved in the past. For Measure, we think the biggest challenge is the two lines, give me your hand and say you will be mine. He is my brother, too, from Act 5, Scene 1. Dan, you want to give us a little context on this?
Yeah, sure. So this is at the end of the play. All the Duke has reemerged and is taking care of everything. He shows Claudio, everyone has assumed was dead. And he's like, nope, he's alive. Also, by the way, Isabella, I'm marrying you. Mm-hmm. And she appropriately says nothing back to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he has the line, you know, give me your hand and say you'll be mine. He is my brother too. Colon. But fitter time for that.
Right.
Just like Great. Okay, cool. I was hoping you might, like, we might do a sonnet here together.
Nope.
Not like in Romeo and Juliet. No, you're not just going to say nothing? Nope. So really, even though we're talking about this line, I think the challenge that we're talking about is how do you handle this whole character, really?
Right.
The Duke is a real, he is a real challenge.
Yes. So, right, the idea that this whole play has been about Isabella being a nun.
Right.
And not wanting to be with anyone and just being devoted to God. So then the Duke, in front of everyone, at the end of this play, just drops, and we're definitely getting married.
Right.
And then...
She's like, I was going to be ordained, like, tomorrow.
Like, I'm done.
Right.
Yeah. So...
Done's the mouse.
Oh.
That's Romeo and Juliet.
Right. And then the rest of the play is literally a conversation between the Duke and Lucio, and then the play ends.
Yeah.
So we never get a rebuttal from Isabella on this.
Right. Notably silent.
Right. And then the third to last line later in the play, before we head out on the couplet... dear Isabel, I have emotion and much imports your good, whereto if you'll a willing ear incline, what's mine is yours and what's yours is mine. So he circles back around to be like, just in case you missed it before,
right?
We should get married.
Right. And we are getting married.
And we don't hear what she says to that.
Right. It's a in productions I've seen of this, it's hard because you kind of root for the Duke the whole time. He's like, he's in hiding, which is also cowardly. God hates a coward.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something to it. When he does this, it's like it's just despicable.
Right.
And I've never really seen an actor make it work where it's like, oh, she totally should be with him.
Right.
I mean, he did just save her brother's life.
Right.
And save her chastity.
Right.
But still, it just undermines everything when he's like, so I get the prize, right?
Yeah.
It's just real.
I mean, the only way I think you could make it work is if somehow it was clear throughout that Isabella was into him.
Yeah.
And I don't know where that is.
It's not in the text.
There's not even like a way to, because her whole time she's trying to figure out how to save her brother. So there's not like a fun time for them to have a moment together.
Right.
You know?
Unless he's saying like, can you make the Duke a priest? And he's not saying they're going to get married. He's like, I'll take you to church to become a nun. Can you make that argument?
I don't think that's what he's saying though. What's mine is yours and what's yours is mine.
Jesus and God. I don't know.
Maybe. It's a reach.
It's a super reach.
Yeah.
But I've never seen that done.
Yeah.
But it's always just been like,
Yeah.
I see what Angelo's going after here. And I think he's kind of right. But I'm just going to do it in a nicer way.
Right. And it's like,
It really qualifies. I guess the nice part is it shows you that no one in the play is an inherently good person. Right. Except for maybe Isabella.
Yeah. Right. That's it. She's on an island.
And poor her, she can't get out of this play.
Right. Right. But yeah, so, I mean, the only way that I've seen it even done, acceptably, but that I liked, was that basically Isabella had that reaction, where he said that, and she was just like, oh, no. Like, yeah. I thought,
not
and was just
too.
Like, crestfallen,
yeah.
That now she has to do this all over again.
Right.
Because, yeah, it doesn't make any sense for her to, like, jump into his arms.
No.
Like, it makes no sense at all with the character that we've seen.
Completely undermines the whole play.
And the fact, you know, Shakespeare putting the stage directions in the text, the fact that he has to say it again.
Right.
And that Isabella has no lines.
Right.
Tells you what you need to know.
I mean, I suppose you can make the argument if you're playing the Duke that he really means, I have emotion, much imports your good, whereto if you'll a willing ear incline. And if you really take the time with that bit, that he is going from saying... we're getting married to, oh, that came out. I would marry you if you'll have me. And she can then be like, no.
Great.
That could work.
Yeah. All right. There
you go. She's like, I'll think about it. I will go pray about it.
Yeah, right. And then when she sneaks off to the church, she just gets nunnerized. And then she's like, I'm a nunnery republic now.
Oh, nice.
There you go. So that's our challenge. Let us know how the director handles it at the production that you're going to see.
Yeah, please do.
All right, folks, that's going to do it for us for this episode. If you found this helpful, please subscribe, rate, and review us in iTunes so that we can keep bringing Shakespeare to your headphones on a weekly basis. If you have questions or comments you'd like to send our way, you can email us at noholdsbarredpodcast@gmail.com, Patreonize us at patreon.com/noholdsbarred, tweet us at noholdsbarredcast, or Facebook us us at facebook.com. No holds barred cast. Until next time, I'm Kevin Condardo.
And I'm Dan Bollier.
So bring us to our palace, where we'll show
what's yet behind. That's meat, you all should know.